opened my eyes. "Hello?" he said again.
"Hey, little man. Do you know who this is?"
"Dad? Dad?"
"Yeah. Yeah, it's me."
"It's so good to hear your voice."
I could no longer see the phone in front of me because my eyes were filled with tears. They started pouring down my cheeks and my nose started running. I was telling myself to keep my composure, but the sound of his sweet voice triggered a longing in me that went to my core.
"Mom said you killed a man and got in a lot of trouble, and they put you in jail, and that you're never coming back. But Grandma says they put you in jail by mistake, and that pretty soon they're gonna let you out, and you can come home. I told Mom you were going to come home, but she just laughed and said Grandma isn't telling me the truth. But I think I'm gonna believe Grandma, because I want you to come home because I miss you."
"I miss you too, buddy."
"Are you crying, Dad?"
"I'm just really glad to hear your voice. It's been a long time since we got to talk."
"I know. Are you going to come home soon?"
"I'm going to try. Listen, Sean, the people here won't let me talk on the phone very long, but now that you're getting to see your grandma again, and now that they're letting me use the phone a little, I'm going to call you every time you come to Grandma's house, okay?"
"Okay."
"I love you."
"I love you too."
"We'll talk again soon. And I promise you I'm going to get home just as soon as I can."
"Bye, Dad."
"Bye."
I hung up the phone, and my legs failed me. I was sobbing as I dropped straight to my knees. Two inmates helped me up and gave up their place in line to help me to a chair in the day room. Chapter 43. I eventually made my way to the United States Penitentiary at Rosewood, California, via Con Air, also known as the Justice Prisoner and Alien Transportation System. Typical Fed name. Long and nonsensical. If I hadn't seen a jet in front of me when I first read the name on a shoulder patch one of the marshals was wearing, I would have thought I was about to be loaded into a rocket and hauled off to an outer space penal colony. When I walked onto the tarmac in Atlanta after having been given virtually no notice that I was leaving, 8 U.S. marshals armed with assault rifles surrounded a Boeing 747. Every prisoner, there were about 60 of us, was cuffed and shackled. I, of course, was also fitted with the black box between my wrists that I'd grown to hate so much during diesel therapy. Other guys had black boxes, too, guys who, like me, were ultimately headed to a maximum security prison. I even saw a couple of guys who were wearing some kind of mesh mittens and others who had thin bags over their heads. The bags meant that at some point those inmates had spit on a guard or a marshal. One guy, I don't know who he was, had what looked like a hockey mask over his face. The rumor later floated on the plane that he was headed for the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. There were another 50 or 60 inmates already on the plane when I boarded. We took off, and 2.5 hours later landed at the Federal Transfer Center in Oklahoma City, which was unique in that it had its very own runway. A jetway came out of the prison straight to the plane. Our feet never touched the ground. The transfer center was a place where nearly every inmate in the federal system passes through for processing. I thought it and Atlanta were redundant, but I was quickly learning that redundancy was one of the things the feds did best. We were herded into holding cells and eventually called out, strip-searched, and processed into one of the housing units. I spent 2 weeks there on the third floor. It was relatively clean, and the food was surprisingly good. Compared to Atlanta and most of the county jails I'd been in, the place was a paradise. From Oklahoma City, I took another Con Air flight to San Francisco, and then a bus to Rosewood, where they strip-searched me, of course, and then processed me. I went through medical and social screening, set up a commissary account, established a phone list and visitors list, met the bureaucrats who worked in the unit, unit manager, case manager, counselor, education advisor. Finally, after a few days of holding, I was assigned to a cell in one of the 4 housing units on the compound. It was early afternoon when I was escorted onto the block, which consisted of 80 cells on 2 levels, was shaped like a trapezoid, and was supposed to be my home for the next 20 years or more. My cell, number 76 in A block of the Jefferson unit, was on the upper level. The block, which was clean and shiny and smelled like antiseptic, was almost empty because most of the inmates were either at their jobs or out on the recreation yard. I dropped my bedroll and extra clothing. The feds outfit inmates in khakis, off at the cell, which was spotless and orderly, and went in search of Mike Big Pappy Donovan. I'd been told by the unit manager that Big Pappy would be waiting for me in his cell, which was number 35, almost directly below mine. I walked up to the open cell door and knocked. "Come on in," a baritone voice with a Midwestern accent said. Pappy was sitting at a small shelf attached to his wall that served as a desk. He stood when I walked into the cell, and I immediately understood why they called him Big Pappy. The man was massive. My guess was 6'7" and maybe 275 pounds of bone and muscle. He was younger than I thought he'd be, maybe 38. His khaki shirt was short-sleeved, but his tattoos ran all the way down both arms to his hands. His neck was also covered in tattoos, and I had no doubt his back and chest would look the same. His hair was shoulder-length and black, pulled into a ponytail. His eyes were chocolate brown and, at the moment, looked genuinely friendly. "You must be Darren Street," he said as he stuck out his hand, which I took. "And you must be Big Pappy. Welcome to Rosewood." "Thank you, I guess." He motioned toward the chair he had vacated. "Take a seat," he said, and he moved over and sat on the bottom bunk. "So, I'm the shot caller for the independent white boy car here in Rosewood. I'm told you don't want a gangbang, so that puts you in my car since you're white. You cool with that?"
"Do I have a choice?"
"Yeah," he said. "Everybody's got a choice. You could refuse to get in my car, but then you're out there on the street all alone surrounded by some of the most dangerous predators you're ever gonna run across. You won't last long."
"So, what are my responsibilities to the group?"
"All you really have to do is be loyal to your brothers," he said. "And when I say brothers, I mean other white guys in this prison who, like you, want to do their time with as little trouble as possible. What does loyalty include? A lot of simple things, but the most important thing is that you have to be willing to fight if it comes down to it. Our car is the biggest in this prison. About 60% of the inmates here are white, and most of the white guys who come here don't want to bang because the bangers are crazy. They get in little skirmishes over turf all the time, and the next thing you know, the skirmish turns into a war and there's blood on the yard. If you have a beef with a banger, whether he's white, black, or Mexican, you come to me. I'll work it out. If I can't work it out, then something's going to go down and you have to be willing to be in the middle of it. If you're not willing, if we can't count on you and you pussy out, you'll answer to me personally. The bangers know we outnumber them, and they know we'll spill blood if we absolutely have to. That's what keeps things peaceful most of the time. Being willing to shed blood makes us safe."
"Sounds like war propaganda to me," I said.
"You should be a recruiter for the Marines." He shrugged his shoulders and smiled. "It is what it is, man," he said. "They tell me you're a lawyer."
"Yeah, well, I used to be a lawyer," I said.
"What else did they tell you?" "That you got a life sentence for murdering a dude who deserved to be murdered, but you say you didn't do it. That you got dieseled for 3 months because some fed doesn't like you or because you put in some work on the guards in Tennessee. How am I doing so far?"
"Pretty good, actually."
"Remember this. There are no secrets in prison. You know my background?"
"I heard you were the shot caller here when I was still in Atlanta, and my understanding of shot caller is that you represent your group in the political structure of the prison. You're the leader. You deal with shot callers from other cars, from gangs, and you negotiate with the guards and the bureaucrats occasionally. Is that basically what you do?"
"I kick some ass once in a while."
"Is that how you became a shot caller in the first place?"
He nodded. "You know that work you put in on the guards in county? I did the same thing when I first came into the federal system. It cost me 2 years in the hole. 2 entire years. Locked down 23 hours a day. Then I did a little work on a couple more guards about a year after they let me out of the hole. Wound up at Marion in the Supermax for 3 years.
"Did you kill them?"
"Nah, I didn't even stab them. But I hurt them all pretty bad. Broke one guy's jaw and nose and broke another guy's leg. Assholes deserved it, too. The Super Max was bad, though. I don't plan to mess with the guards anymore, but they don't know that. They keep their distance. So you're the shot caller because of what you've done in the past. It's a respect thing, Big Pappy said. Respect is the most important commodity in prison, and I'm not talking about respect from the guards. Respect from other inmates is what will keep you alive. Yeah, I said. That's what I keep hearing. How long have you been in? I'm in my 11th year of a 35-year sentence. I was told drugs? Coke. Were you guilty? Absolutely not. Set up by a crooked cop. Hired an idiot for a lawyer, and here I am. I've pretty much exhausted the appeals process, which is something I want to talk to you about as soon as you get settled in. Are you planning to set up shop in the law library?
If they'll let me.
They'll let you, he said. And so will I. I won't even ask for a cut, on one condition.
Yeah? What's that?
Your first client has to be me.
Chapter 44. My new cellmate was a short, skinny, acne-scarred white guy named Dino Long. All I knew about him before I walked into the cell was what I'd been told by the unit manager and the unit counselor. The feds tried to match people up as best they could so they didn't have serious problems in the cells, but they never knew for sure. They told me Dino Long was a little strange, but was considered to be an okay guy. Like more than half of the inmates at the prison, he had been convicted of a nonviolent drug offense, but he was in max because he was on the front end of a 30-year sentence. He worked in the kitchen and had been at Rosewood for only 6 months. They told me his previous cellmate had suffered a massive stroke and had been transferred to another prison with a better rehab facility. Dino hadn't been in the cell when I went downstairs to talk to Big Pappy, but when I came back, he was sitting at the little desk, writing on a piece of notebook paper with a pencil. He didn't look up or acknowledge that I'd walked into the cell, so I started unrolling my bedroll.
"Don't ever touch my stuff,"
he said a few minutes later. I stopped what I was doing and turned to face him. I thought I'd probably have to fight him, but he wasn't looking at me. He was still writing. "I'm not planning to touch your stuff," I said.
"I'm a firm believer in the power of Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior."
"Good for you."
"Are you religious?"
"No."
"Your loss,"
Dino said.
"Are you tough? I've heard you're a tough guy."
"Yeah, who told you that?"
"A fairy."
"I'm not a tough guy, and I'm not looking for trouble. I just want to get the hell out of here as soon as I can."
"I thought you had a life sentence."
"Good God," I said. "This place is like a sewing circle. You guys know more about me than I know about myself."
"And you're a lawyer, right?" "They told me you're a lawyer. Should I call you counselor?"
"You should call me Darren." "And I should call you?"
"Dino."
"Dino."
"Good.
Okay. Yes, I was a lawyer on the outside, which seems to be the first thing everybody wants to talk about, but
the psychologist here thinks I'm mentally ill,"
he said.
"Not bad enough to be institutionalized or anything. Not bad enough to be dangerous to other people. But he thinks I'm bipolar, and I might be a danger to myself. He says that's why I snorted so much cocaine. To self-medicate, you know. And that's why I started selling it the way I did. It wasn't really my fault that I lived in a big city and had some friends in Miami who could get kilos for me, and that I knew a bunch of people who could distribute for me because I went to college and liked to party. Do you think something like that would be my fault?"
"Something like what?" I said.
"Like being born rich in Pittsburgh and going to Carnegie Mellon and knowing people in Miami who could get kilos for me. Is that my fault?"
I shrugged my shoulders.
I didn't want to get into a discussion about choices and responsibilities with him. He was talking fast and his voice sounded like it was cracking. Lecturing or judging him just didn't seem to be the right thing to do at the time.
"I don't know, man," I said.
"My parents are extremely disappointed in me,"
he said.
"The feds seized every dime I had as soon as they arrested me, so my parents wound up paying a lawyer $100,000 for my defense. Can you believe that? $100,000? And I was guilty of sin, and I knew it, but I lied and told them I hadn't done anything and that I was being framed, and they paid this lawyer and we went to trial, and after the jury found me guilty, the judge hammered me."
"I know the feeling," I said, hoping he would stop.
He spun around on the concrete stool that served as a chair and looked at me. His hair was light brown, and his eyes light green and forlorn. He looked at me intensely for what seemed like forever, as though he was studying me.
"What kind of person are you?"
he finally said. I shook my head. "That's a strange question," I said. "I guess I don't really know for sure. I think I'm a good person. I try to be a good person."
"Are you hateful? Are you judgmental?"
"I don't think so. It'd be pretty difficult to be hateful and judgmental and practice criminal defense law, which is what I did for a living before I wound up here."
"My last cellmate was disgusting," he said. "He was old and bigoted and narrow-minded, and I'm glad he stroked out like he did. He deserved it."
"No offense," I said, "but for somebody who's concerned about me being judgmental, you sound like a..."
"Do you know what pushed him over the edge?"
Dino said.
"The thing that made him have a stroke?"
"No idea."
"We were right here, talking just the way you and I are talking right now. He was standing where you're standing, and I was sitting just like I am now. He was ranting and raving about his faggot son, and I said, 'Do you know that bisexual men and women are far more likely to have gay sons or lesbian daughters than straight people? Is there a chance you might be bisexual?' I have no idea whether what I said to him is true, but it absolutely freaked him out. He turned pink and took a step toward me, and he raised his fist. And then I said, 'And guess what, big boy? You've been rooming with a fag for the past 5 months.' The next thing I knew, he was jerking on the floor like a chicken with its head cut off."
I stood there looking at him for a few seconds, not quite knowing how to respond. When I did say something, it was idiotic.
"So you're telling me you're gay?"
"Congratulations, genius," he said. "I just think we should be honest with each other if we're going to live together. I promise I won't try to get in your pants. And if you're really a good guy, I'd appreciate it if you'd keep my little secret to yourself."
Chapter 45. Over the next year, I fell into the mind-numbing routine of life at Rosewood. Birthdays and holidays were just like every other day. Nothing ever changed, with the exception of my marital status. 6 months in, Katie was granted a divorce. They didn't go so far as to terminate my parental rights, and my mother was allowed to continue her visitation with Sean, but it was a hollow victory. The only thing that made my existence seem real was the constant fear and the violence. Guards would attack inmates. Inmates would attack guards. Inmates would attack inmates. I'll never forget the screams I heard one morning when an inmate went into another inmate's cell and poured a cup of baby oil that had been superheated in a microwave onto the sleeping man's face. I stepped out of my cell and saw the man stagger out into the middle of the common area on the first floor. He was clutching at his face. The skin came off in his hands. The cells popped at 5:45 each morning. I rolled out of bed, and it began. Make the bed, do 100 push-ups and 100 crunches, shower, go to the chow hall, head for the law library and get some work done, back to the cell to stand for count, back to the law library, back to the chow hall, back to the law library, out to the rec yard for a run, to the workout room twice a week to exercise, stand for count, to the gym twice a week to play basketball, chow hall for evening meal, study law and work on cases in the evenings, stand for count, lock down at 9:30 p.m., go to sleep, get up and do it again the next day. Dino showed me the ropes initially, what little he knew, and I gradually made acquaintances with some guys I was comfortable talking with, a couple of whom were from Tennessee. I learned from them and Big Pappy how things worked, or at least how they were supposed to work, and all about the different cars and gangs in the prison. They also told me which guards were corrupt, which ones were half-decent human beings, and which ones were straight-up hard-asses who liked to either hurt people or see them get hurt. Everybody had their hustle, including the guards. There were the card tables and the dice games, the homemade wine and liquor, the tobacco, the drugs, the protection rackets, and the stores. Most of the hustles, especially the most lucrative, were controlled by the gangs who paid the guards to turn their heads. Big Pappy controlled 3 card tables and about a quarter of the tobacco that was smuggled into the prison. There was a huge markup on tobacco, even though it was legal on the streets. One cigarette cost a book of stamps, which cost about $6. Pappy told me he could get a pouch of Bugler rolling tobacco smuggled into him by a guard for about $100. He got 80 cigarettes out of a pouch and sold them for $6 each. Since almost everybody in the place smoked, he and his little crew sold more than 1,000 cigarettes a week, which meant he was making nearly $5,000 a week selling cigarettes. I stayed away from it all, though. I didn't drink, I didn't touch a drug, didn't gamble, and rarely spoke to a gangbanger unless it was about a legal issue. I kept my distance from the guards, too. They were at the bottom of the law enforcement food chain. Men and women who were underpaid and unappreciated, and who would lie, cheat, and steal for each other if it meant saving their own asses. I actually had more respect for murderers, robbers, and drug dealers than I did for many of the guards. My hustle was law. I started taking cases about 10 days after I was given a cell at Rosewood. Everything, of course, was post-conviction appellate work, either direct appeals, petitions to the U.S. Supreme Court for review, or habeas corpus petitions. I hadn't done much appellate work on the outside, but I learned the rules and procedures of the appellate courts quickly. The prison provided me access to online legal databases, so I was able to work efficiently. The first thing I did was set up a corporation in Nevada where the privacy laws are so strong that corporate records are nearly impenetrable. My mom helped me with it. We sent the application through the mail and had the paperwork delivered to her. I was the president of our little corporation, and she was the vice president. I then sent instructions to my mom to set up a corporate bank account into which I could have prisoners direct deposit money if they decided to hire me for a case. I hid those instructions to my mother in legal mail that I was sending to Grace, because the prison censors couldn't read my legal correspondence. Grace could have gotten in trouble if anyone in the legal system found out. But when I sent her a letter and asked her if I could send something to my mom through her, she wrote back and said, absolutely. Giving mom access to the corporate bank account meant she could get the money I was earning and use it for her and Sean. Katie didn't know a thing about it, which was exactly the way I wanted it. Prisoners don't have access to the internet, but they do have access to tightly controlled email accounts. If a fellow prisoner wanted to hire me and I agreed to take the case, I would quote him a fee and give him instructions on how to deposit the money into our corporate account. Once the money was transferred, I would get an email from my mother about some random subject that ended with, P.S. Sean is doing well. I'm very proud of him. Big Pappy Donovan was my first client. He paid me, too. I asked him for $2,000, and he didn't even flinch. It was no wonder, considering the amount of money he was making every week from the gambling and the cigarettes. It wasn't until after we'd agreed on a fee that I learned how much he was pulling down with the gambling and tobacco. I should have charged him double. Pappy's case was interesting from the beginning, and although I didn't tell him, I thought we had a chance to get some relief. It was similar to mine, actually, although Pappy's case involved a crooked cop instead of a crooked prosecutor. The cop had a personal grudge against Pappy because, according to Pappy, Pappy had stolen a woman from him when they were all in their early 20s. They came from a small town in Georgia called Hawkinsville, just south of Macon. Pappy had played football at Mercer University and had returned to Hawkinsville, where he was in his second year as an assistant coach on the Hawkinsville High School football team and teaching biology to sophomores. He ran into a woman named Paisley Grant in a bar one Saturday night. He'd known Miss Grant in high school. She was attending a birthday party for one of her friends. She and Big Pappy started talking, hit it off, and wound up having sex in his truck in the parking lot. I actually liked the girl, Pappy told me. We started dating pretty seriously after that. I saw her almost every Saturday night and would talk to her once or twice during the week. It finally fizzled out after about 4 months, but I enjoyed it while it lasted. She didn't tell me she'd been dating Ronnie Ray when we met at the bar, and she didn't tell me she broke it off with him. Not that it would have mattered. I'd known Ronnie Ray since junior high. He was a pussy. Not just any pussy. When Ronnie Ray first learned that Big Pappy Donovan had snaked his girlfriend, he was a patrol officer for the Pulaski County Sheriff's Department. But within a year, Ray was assigned to a federal drug task force that worked southern Georgia. He apparently used that position to take revenge on Big Pappy, because he eventually arrested him for 6 counts of possessing and distributing crack cocaine, offenses that were punishable by up to life in prison. Ray filed the charge, and along with an informant, was the feds' star witness at trial. Pappy was convicted and sentenced to 35 years, and he claimed to me that every word out of Ray's mouth was a lie. He'd never seen or used crack, let alone sold it. I believed him, too. After what had happened to me and to my uncle, I knew how easy it was to railroad someone if a cop or a prosecutor really wanted it done. Pappy had run the gamut of appeals and thought he might be finished the first time he came to see me. After we talked for a while, I asked him about the truck he said they had confiscated. "I love that truck," he said. "Hadn't had it long, but I loved it." "Let's sue the county to get the truck back," I said. "We won't win, but we can ask for all of the investigative materials related to your case, and maybe something will shake loose." A month later, Pappy received an answer to the lawsuit, and a month after that, he received an envelope full of papers from the county's lawyers, containing discovery material I'd requested. Among the papers were some of Ronnie Ray's investigative notes. Pappy brought them to me with a grin on his face the day they arrived in the mail. "This says there was a videotape of the informant being debriefed," Pappy said to me. "That guy was a piece of garbage. I guarantee Ronnie coached him." "Maybe," I said. "I'll try to get a judge to make them turn it over if nobody's destroyed it." "Cops keep everything," he said. "That's one thing I've learned after all these years of appeals. But there's something better." Pappy laid out several more sheets of paper. They were copies of Ronnie Ray's investigative notes, ostensibly created during the times that Pappy was selling crack to the informant. Ray's notes said he was observing the buys. They listed the make, model, and license plate number of Pappy's pickup and the dates and times of the buys, along with some brief descriptions of what was allegedly going on. "These might be it," he said. "These might be the smoking gun." I looked at them and shook my head. They looked pretty much like every other set of investigative notes I'd ever seen. "I don't get it," I said. "See the dates?" Pappy said. "Yeah, so? I traded trucks. I didn't buy the truck that's listed on here until 6 weeks after the last time he says I sold crack. He's been lying all along, and this'll prove it. Can you get it in front of a judge?" "I can try. Make it happen. You get me out of this place, and I'll owe you big time." I filed Big Pappy's motion for a new trial with the trial court in Georgia, and amazingly, we got a response in less than 8 weeks. Apparently Ronnie Ray had been accused of doing some unsavory things, and the federal magistrate wanted an evidentiary hearing. He even appointed Pappy a lawyer to conduct the hearing. They set a date, and 2 months after that, Pappy was shipped out. He was gone for 5 weeks. When he came back, he came straight to my cell. "He admitted that he lied, man," Pappy said. "The lawyer pressed him, and he didn't have an answer. And you know that tape you asked the judge for? He made them produce it. My lawyer took a look at it and said it was the worst example of witness tampering he'd ever seen in his life." "So what are you doing back here?" I said. "The judge said he'd issue a written opinion. Should have it before too much longer. And guess what else? I called my lawyer when I was in Oklahoma on my way back here. They fired Ronnie Ray 2 days after the hearing. He's gone, man. I hate to even think about it, but this could really happen. I could wind up getting out of here." Chapter 46. Not long after Pappy got his good news, I received a letter from Grace that contained the appellate court's opinion in my own case, saying my trial was clean and confirming my conviction. I read the opinion 3 times, and each time I felt a little smaller, a little more insignificant. Judges are extremely careful at the trial level because they don't want an appellate court tossing a case back into their lap a year or two later. In my case, Judge Gere had been particularly deliberate in his rulings. I had no doubt that he had called friends of his, other judges, including appellate judges, prior to making rulings in my case, so he had the best possible chance of getting everything right. And after reading the opinion of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals over and over, I realized that I was not going to get any relief based on mistakes. If I was going to get my case reversed, James Tipton would have to step forward and tell the world why he'd lied. Not only would he have to tell the world he'd lied, he would also have to do it in an extremely convincing fashion. Witnesses recanting testimony was nothing new to the appellate courts. It happened all the time. And 9 times out of 10, the appellate court said, so what? If I was to ever get out of federal prison, James Tipton would have to come into court with something explosive. The problem with that, of course, was that we didn't have any idea where James Tipton was. After I read the opinion and fumed for a little while, I decided to go outside for a run around the rec yard to blow off some of the frustration I was feeling. A man walked up to me just as I finished. I'd seen him around my cell block, but I didn't know him. The tattoo on his right forearm told me he was a member of the Sons of Odin gang. The SOs were a relatively small upstart group who said they patterned themselves after a German deity called Odin. Odin, they claimed, rode an 8-legged steed and traveled with ravens and wolves. They were known to be violent. I'd witnessed an incident in our cell block a few weeks earlier in which an SO, after having been tipped off by a guard that a new inmate was a particularly scummy sex offender, beat the guy unconscious on the walkway that ran along the second tier of cells on our block, then dragged him down the steps by his feet onto the floor, and then mounted him and started beating his head against the floor. The sex offender apparently lived, but I don't know how. The beating was almost as brutal as the one the guards in Atlanta had dished out to the Macho Man. The gang member got 3 months in the hole. He didn't even catch a formal charge. The guy who approached me looked like a juicer, a steroid user. A lot of guys in prison juiced. Bringing in steroids like Dianabol and Winstrol and Decadurabolin and human growth hormone was one of the medium-sized hustles, and from what I'd been told, there was decent money in it. He was about 3 inches taller and 30 or 40 pounds heavier than me, and he had a puffy face and looked like someone had injected helium into his muscles. His neck was thick beneath his shaved head. Both arms were sleeved in tattoos, and he had fierce-looking aquamarine blue eyes. "You the warrior man?" he said, as he folded his arms in front of his chest. "Yeah," I said. I noticed immediately that something about him wasn't quite right. His left eye wandered a tiny bit, and he had a slight speech impediment. Lawyer was very close to warrior. "You need to file an appeal for me." "Really?" I said, sensing danger in his tone. "How far along are you in the process?"
"What are you talking about?"
"The process. How long have you been in prison? How many appeals have you filed? I need to know where you are before I can make a decision on whether we can file."
"I said you need to file an appeal for me, and that's what you need to do."
"Do you have money?" I said. "I don't work for free."
"You'll work for free from me."
I looked over his shoulder and saw a few of his boys, fellow gang members, sitting at a picnic table they occupied every day on the yard. They were looking at us and laughing. One of them was pointing. Less than 100 feet away was the table where Big Pappy was sitting with his usual crew. I noticed he was watching, too. "Mind if we walk while I cool down?" I said. I was still breathing pretty heavily from the run, and I wanted to get closer to Pappy and his independent white boys in case something happened.
"We stay right here," he said.
"You got a name, asshole?" I said belligerently, deliberately insulting him. He'd already disrespected me, and I couldn't just let it go.
"Of course I got a fucking name," he said. "Everybody got a fucking name."
"Mine's Darren," I said. "What's yours?"
"Robert Edward Lee Frazier," he said. "My boys call me Bobby Lee. You can call me Sir Robert."
"Okay," I said. "Go fuck yourself, Sir Robert." I brushed past him and started walking away from the fence toward Big Pappy and his group. I needed to get away from Sir Robert. I didn't want to get trapped against the fence. I could feel adrenaline kicking in as I anticipated a fight. It had been a while since I'd been in a physical altercation, but I'd stayed in excellent physical condition, and I wasn't afraid. I took 3 or 4 steps and turned to look at him to see where he was. He'd hesitated, probably because I'd surprised him. He was such an intimidating figure that I was sure he was used to people cowing to him. The hesitation didn't last long, though. I heard him curse under his breath, and the next thing I knew, he was charging me like an enraged bull. I sidestepped him and managed to punch him in the ear with my right fist as he went past. I could hear and sense commotion to my left, but I had to stay focused on Sir Robert, who regained his balance, turned toward me, and put his fists up in a boxing stance. Around this time, I heard amplified voices from the guard towers. I reacted to Sir Robert's boxing stance by kicking him squarely in the scrotum. He bent over, and I kicked him in the face. He staggered forward, and I kicked him in the face again, which sent him to his knees. Strong hands began pulling on my shirt, and strong arms wrapped around me, restraining me. I became aware of a voice in my ear. "Easy, dude, easy now." The voice belonged to Big Pappy. I then became aware of yelling and cursing and people surging around me. There was another amplified sound, this one of a shotgun round being pumped into the chamber. It was a recording the guards played over the loudspeakers when trouble was brewing. Then there was gunfire from a guard tower, and everyone was on his stomach on the ground. The last thing I heard before two guards dragged me off to the hole was Sir Robert's voice. "You're dead, motherfucker," he yelled. "You're a dead man." Chapter 47. They walked me out of the special housing unit, also known as the hole, a month after I kicked Bobby Lee Frazier in the nuts. It didn't matter that Bobby had started the fight. All that mattered was that I had been involved in a fight with another inmate, and the institution, by its own rules, had to punish me for it. The punishment was being locked down in the darkness for 23 hours a day, 1 hour of rec, no phone privileges, one short shower a week, and no contact with anyone other than the guards who brought cold food, usually bologna sandwiches, which were slid through the pie hole twice a day. It was back to the existence I'd lived early on during my incarceration, the existence of an animal. It also put all of my legal cases on hold, but I was fortunate in that I didn't miss any deadlines. The system worked excruciatingly slow, especially when it came to prisoners who are representing themselves or using a jailhouse lawyer. But the system would have been more than happy to spit a case out and bar it forever because the jailhouse lawyer was cooling his jets in the hole and missed a filing deadline. But the institution and my legal work were the least of my problems. I had attacked a gang member, a son of Odin. I didn't kill him, but I'd knocked him down in front of everybody. I'd embarrassed him. The fact that he deserved it didn't matter. The SOs would be looking for me as soon as I walked back out onto the yard. They had to back up their boy. I didn't know how they'd come at me, whether it would be one guy or two or five, or whether they'd bring knives or shanks or clubs or maybe even a gun. But I knew as certain as the sun would rise and set that they were coming. The thought entered my mind a couple of times that all I had to do was put up no resistance, just let them kill me, and I would be free of the nightmare I'd been living. But I knew when they came, I'd fight them with everything I had. As I walked through the metal detector and into the cell block, I was keenly aware of my surroundings. Frazier lived on the same block, although he lived downstairs and several cells over. It was late afternoon, and a lot of the inmates had come into the block from the rec yard or the chow hall. Guys were moving in and out of the cells and the workout rooms or sitting at the card tables. I didn't see Frazier or any of his gang brothers. I walked up the steps, went into my cell, and was relieved to see Dino sitting there. The place was spotless. Dino smiled, stood up, and put out his hand. "Welcome back, Darren," he said. "Thanks." "And how was the hole?"
"Dark and smelly, pretty much like you'd expect."
"Was there a toilet there, or do they make you use a bucket?"
"Toilet, Dino."
"Good, good. I was envisioning you having to squat—"
"Dino, please. Didn't you have anything better to think about?" I noticed a shadow behind me and turned quickly. I was relieved to see Big Pappy's wide frame filling the doorway.
"Mind if I come in?"
he said, as if we had a choice. Still, he was polite about it, which was important in the etiquette-conscious world of the convicted felon.
"It looks like you made it in one piece," Pappy said.
"Yeah," I said. "I think I'll live."
"That's what I came to talk to you about," Pappy said. "Mind if I take a seat?"
"Suit yourself," I said. As Pappy moved toward the concrete stool,
Dino began to wiggle by him.
"I'll just go downstairs until you're finished," Dino said.
"Might as well stay," Pappy said. "You're a celly. You need to hear this, too."
I leaned against the corner of the top bunk while Dino sat on the bottom bunk.
"Bobby Lee's still in the hole," Big Pappy said. "They gave him 2 weeks more than you because he was the aggressor, even though you whipped him. It's a problem, though, Darren. It's a problem for you, for Bobby Lee, for his car, my car, for everybody. I mean, this could potentially blow up big. You know what I mean?
Not really, I said.
It could turn into a riot, or at least a huge fight, which would mean lockdown for everybody for a couple of months minimum. But I met up with Midas. You know Midas, right?
Shot caller for the Sons of Odin.
Big nasty-looking guy. He's an okay dude, you know? Just doing what everybody else is doing, which is time. Trying to get his hustle on while he's doing his time. But he got into this little Odin thing a few years back, and now he's the man, and there isn't any going back for him. They all look up to him, and he has to do right by his people. I can totally respect that. One of those people is this dim-witted cracker, Bobby Lee. Bobby Lee's got some mental problems. Some shit caused by him getting pounded on by his stepfather that tried to kill him when he was 3 or 4 years old. So Midas looks at Bobby Lee kind of like a son. He says he's got this father complex for him. But he realizes that Bobby Lee did wrong. I mean, you don't just go jump a man the way he did to you out on the yard without somebody's prior approval, without letting somebody know what was going to happen. He didn't ask permission from Midas or anything.
I don't believe that, I said. With all due respect, of course. Midas and his friends were watching the whole thing. They were laughing.
Maybe they knew, maybe they didn't, Pappy said. The point is, though, that he says he didn't know. Now we have to go forward without the yard going up in smoke. You understand that's why the feds allow the whole gang thing to go on, don't you? They could stop it if they wanted, but they let it go on. You understand why?
I suppose it has something to do with discipline.
Exactly, Pappy said. Discipline and control. The gangs command discipline. They have rules. Gang members have to live within those rules. When they break the rules, they're disciplined by their own. Otherwise, this place would get out of hand in a heartbeat. There would be constant fights, constant riots, and constant killings.
So you're saying Bobby Lee broke the rules when he came after me on the yard without getting permission from his shot caller?
Right. And now he's going to pay the price.
Which is?
He's lost his backup. He's on his own.
I shook my head, still not quite understanding.
I don't get it, I said. I told Midas that I'd keep my boys out of it if he'd keep his out of it, Pappy said. But he's still gonna come, Darren. He's gonna come alone, and he has to keep it private.
Private? You mean
he'll come here. He'll come to the cell, and he'll be armed. Do you have a weapon?
I shook my head.
Get one. He'll be out in 14 days. If you handle him, it'll be over, even if you kill him. Midas says it's between the two of you now.
And if he kills me?
I guess you'll be dead and the rest of us will keep on living. That's just the way it has to be.
Chapter 48. He came the same day he got out of the hole. I was in my cell, lying in my bunk, reading a legal brief I'd printed out in the library. Dino was there, sitting at the desk writing a letter to his mother. It was 8:30 or so, about an hour before we'd be locked down for the night. I'd looked for Bobby Lee Frazier all day because I knew he was scheduled to get out of the hole, but I hadn't seen him. I found myself hoping he'd done something in the hole to get his stay extended, or maybe the powers that be had decided to transfer him to another max. It started with a warning from below. Someone down on one of the card tables saw Bobby Lee walk into the block, stop by his cell for a few seconds, and then head straight for the staircase. Bobby Lee's cell was downstairs. Mine was upstairs.
"Trouble coming your way, Darren Street,"
a voice called out. By the time I jumped down off the bunk and chased Dino out of the cell, Bobby Lee was in the doorway. I saw him lift his shirt and pull out an ice pick that was at least a foot long. And then it was just Bobby Lee and me in the small cell together. He was so big, he seemed to fill the entire space. I hadn't gotten a weapon, as Big Pappy had suggested. I just couldn't make myself do it. I couldn't picture myself as a knife fighter. But as I stood there looking at that pointed steel, I wished I had something to even things up a little.
He came at me slowly this time, remembering, I suppose, what I'd done to him when he bull-rushed me on the yard. I was focused so intently on the ice pick that I didn't react quickly enough when he punched me with his left fist, his empty hand. The punch caught me in the right temple and sent me staggering back against the wall, and then he was on me. I felt the ice pick slip into my belly the first time and remembered thinking it didn't hurt as badly as I'd thought it would. I started punching Bobby Lee in the face with everything I had, but he stayed right in front of me. He wouldn't go down, and I didn't have room to maneuver and grapple with him. In the meantime, I kept feeling the ice pick again and again. I remember my vision starting to blur. Then I started to get cold. At some point, I had what I believed to be a dream of someone cutting Bobby Lee's throat. A large knife appeared out of nowhere and slid across his neck from under his left ear all the way across to beneath his right ear. I was showered in warm blood. I began to slide down the wall. Warm blood was also running down my lower body. It was almost pleasant. My head became lighter and lighter. I looked up and thought I saw Dino standing over Bobby Lee holding a knife. Big Pappy walked into the cell and took the knife from Dino's hand. I think. And then I left my body and floated to the ceiling, where I watched the guards come in first, and then the medical people. I wanted to float outside the cell, through the roof, out of the prison, and off to a different and better place. But I couldn't. Something was making me stay. I later found out what it was. Life. Life made me stay. Bobby Lee Frazier had stabbed me 11 times with that ice pick, but he didn't kill me. The human body can withstand an incredible amount of abuse and still survive. Unfortunately, I was living proof. Chapter 49. Prison infirmaries are almost as good as the military when it comes to trauma care. They see a lot of stab wounds, and they're well-trained when it comes to reacting to life-and-death situations. The staff at Rosewood, I was told, was as good as it gets. I didn't know whether I should regard that as a blessing or a curse. I lost a lot of blood, but a transfusion had taken care of that. The stab wounds had punctured various organs and had perforated my bowel in a couple of places, but the doctors had worked their surgical magic and seemed to think I'd be fine in a few months. They had done all they could with the wounds and were managing the pain with medications. Now all I had to do was heal. On my fourth day in the infirmary, a female officer came to see me. She was a green-eyed, pale-skinned redhead of around 40, tall and slim with rounded shoulders.
She smelled of soap in her starched uniform and had a business-like, matter-of-fact air about her.
Her name tag said Gibbons. She didn't ask me how I was feeling or whether I was comfortable talking to her. She just walked into the room and stood next to the bed.
"I'm investigating the stabbing that took place in your cell,"
she said without introducing herself. I nodded.
"Are you willing to talk about it?"
she asked.
"Not really."
"Why not? You were almost killed."
"You know how it is," I said. "If I talk to you, all I do is cause problems for myself. Either you'll charge me with something, or you'll charge somebody else with something and want me to be witness. I wind up with a charge or labeled as a snitch. It's lose-lose for me."
"I'm not going to charge you with anything,"
she said.
"All I'm looking for is confirmation of some things we already know."
"If you already know, then you don't need confirmation."
"Mr. Frazier came to your cell armed with an ice pick, is that correct?"
she said.
"Somebody was obviously armed with an ice pick. I have the holes in me to prove it."
"And it was Mr. Frazier?"
"I didn't say that." "Didn't you find an ice pick on whoever was in my cell?"
She shook her head.
"The weapons had been removed from the cell by the time our people were able to get in and secure the scene."
"Weapons? As in more than one?"
"I didn't have a weapon."
"There were two weapons used in the altercation, Mr. Street. An ice pick and a knife. A butcher knife had been stolen from the kitchen where your cellmate, Mr. Long, happened to work. We think that was the second weapon."
"Dino didn't give me a knife," I said.
"Wait just a second.
What happened to the guy who stabbed me? You say his name is Frazier? Where is he?"
"He's dead. You didn't see someone nearly cut his head off?"
I lifted my arm and covered my eyes.
I dreamed it,
I said. At least I thought I was dreaming it.
Must have been a pretty vivid dream. You had blood all over you. I've never seen so much blood in a cell, and I've seen a lot. So in this dream of yours, who was holding the knife? Was it your cellmate, Mr. Long?
I have no idea. I'd been stabbed a bunch of times. I was going down, fading out, and I had this dream where I thought I saw a knife cutting a throat.
What you saw was your cellmate, Mr. Long, cutting Bobby Lee Frazier's throat. Mr. Long was covered in blood, too, when we got in there. But while you and Mr. Frazier were bleeding all over the place, somebody took the weapons. We've searched for them, but we're probably not going to find them. Weapons tend to disappear when something like this happens. It's certainly nothing new. Inmates get rid of as much evidence as they can and then clam up. Nobody saw anything. As far as we're concerned, anything you did was in self-defense, so you're not looking at another charge. They're not even going to send you back to the special housing unit for fighting after you get out of here. But just for administrative purposes, I'd like to know whether you saw Mr. Long kill Mr. Frazier.
Administrative purposes? That's what you call pinning a murder charge on Dino Long, who may very well have saved my life? And you want me to be a witness? Forget it, lady. Not a snowball's chance in hell.
From the evidence I've seen, Mr. Long used deadly force and killed Mr. Frazier in defense of another, which, as I'm sure you know since you were a lawyer on the outside, is a recognized legal defense to a charge of murder. But even if I wanted to charge Mr. Long with murder and have him take his chances with a jury, I couldn't do it.
Why not? I said. Does the warden have you guys on a short leash?
Mr. Long is dead, she said. He hanged himself in a holding cell while we were conducting our investigation. So even if I wanted to, there's nobody left to charge.
Dino was dead?
I closed my eyes and opened them again, hoping once again that I was somehow dreaming and not living this nightmare that wouldn't seem to end. Dino had never struck me as the kind of guy who would do violence. He was quiet, almost meek most of the time. And she was probably right. He must have gotten the knife he used from the kitchen, but he hadn't said a word to me about it, and he knew, just as I did, that Bobby Lee would come to our cell. That meant he intended all along to fight with me, to fight for me. He'd killed a man for me, and the weight of the act had apparently crushed his already fragile psyche. I turned my head toward the wall as my body howled for more pain medication. Get out, I said to the guard.
So you don't want...
Get the fuck out of here! I yelled, and she turned and strutted out of the room. Chapter 50. I was sitting in the chow hall eating lunch when Big Pappy came hurrying in. I'd been out of the infirmary for only a week and had finally gotten through the withdrawal symptoms from the narcotic painkillers I'd taken. It had also taken a few days to get used to Dino not being there. All of his things had been cleared out and, I assumed, shipped to his parents. I thought of him often while I was in the infirmary, but each time I did, the last image in my mind was of him hanging from a belt. I spent a lot of time blaming myself, telling myself that if I hadn't reacted violently on the yard with Bobby Lee, none of this would have happened, and Dino would still be alive. It was sad and painful, but I realized during that time that I'd been through so much sorrow and pain over the past 18 months that I was becoming numb to it. It was as though my heart had become calloused, and I wondered whether I would ever be able to feel anything meaningful again. Pappy stood over me, smiling. He was carrying a sheaf of papers in his right hand.
You did it, he said. You did it, Darren. Check this out.
He handed me a 40-page opinion written by the federal magistrate who had heard the evidence that was presented when he'd gone back to Georgia a couple of months earlier. The judge had found that Ronnie Ray, the police officer, had perjured himself during the trial and that the video of the informant being debriefed revealed dozens of inconsistencies that could have been used by Pappy's lawyer at trial to impeach the informant. The judge wrote that Pappy had been denied a fair trial and ordered a new trial in the federal district court.
You know what this means, don't you?
I said.
It means you're out of here. There's no way they're going to retry you on something like this. They could appeal, but they'd be beating a dead horse.
Your ticket is punched, big guy. You're as good as gone.
That's what I was hoping you'd say, man. I can't believe it.
He sat down across from me and took a deep breath. I'd come in late and was one of only four guys in the chow hall. Pappy made five. The other three were sitting together across the room.
I wonder how long it will take them to process you out of here and get you back to Georgia, I said. You'd think they'd move pretty quick, right? I mean, this judge practically says I was railroaded and shouldn't be here.
I'll bet I'm gone inside a month.
Congratulations, Pappy, I said. I'm happy for you.
And I owe you, he said. I mean it. I owe you. What can I do?
I'd actually thought about having this conversation many times since Pappy had told me what happened at the hearing when he went back to